Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
Now, this story is one that's going to get everyone's attention if you go into the hospital at all. There's a very bad bacteria that is in hospitals now. It's called Clostridium difficile, and it's also out there in the community. It is normally kept in check. Even if you've got it or a touch of it in your intestine, it's normally kept in check by all of your other bacteria. C. difficile is a weakling. It doesn't actually compete very well. The only thing it does really well is survive most of our modern antibiotics. As a result, when a person gets high-dose antibiotics, particularly intravenous, but also oral, they can kill off all of those protective bacteria that are keeping the C. difficile in check. The C. difficile is left with an empty field with lots of food, and guess what it does? It causes a persistent diarrhea and pain that is just a bear to cure. The actual cure rates on this can be as low as 50% the first time we drew it, and recurrence is common. So we'd really like to avoid C. difficile. Researchers collected 3,000 samples from people hospitalized with this and looked at another 1,600 swabs taken for environmental surfaces in the state of Texas. Plus, they swabbed the soles of shoes of both doctors, nurses, and non-healthcare workers who were just coming to visit somebody in the hospital. Well, what they found was that 26% of the community shoe samples, one quarter of them, had toxigenic strains that were the same ones that were found in the hospital specimens. So, that was across the board. 64% of doctors' and nurses' shoes had C. difficile on them. That means, folks, that you're tracking it back home, where an infant or an older person on chemotherapy could conceivably get very, very sick from it. Now, just like the methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, once these things show up in the hospitals, they track back. Now, what we're going to try to do is think about putting on shoe covers. And certainly when I go into the hospitals from now on, bum-ba-da-dum, I'm going to have some shoe covers in the car and be trying to do just that. We've got our first caller. And hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. This is Pure Heart. My neighbor had some kind of a hepatitis from Vietnam, I guess it was. And he got treated with interferon, which caused some kind of dementia, and he passed very quickly. But that's the kind of sad thing. But what I'm calling about is hepatitis C. There's some kind of expensive pill that will cure it, you know, for example. And that kind of goes in line with your talking about expensive pills. Could you go into hepatitis C, what that is, and that pill, if you know anything about that?
I sure will.
Can I hang up?
Yeah, you can hang up if you don't have any follow-up questions. That'd be fine.
I'm just curious. Okay, thank you.
All right, bye-bye. So hepatitis C used to be called non-A, non-B hepatitis because we didn't have a test for it. There's actually a hepatitis D, which we rarely talk about. But anyway, hepatitis C is spread by intravenous drug use and sex and contact with blood. So if you're cleaning up after a nosebleed, that could be a problem. It's similar to hepatitis B in a good way. It's not as contagious as hepatitis B, which is super contagious. But in a bad way, we also don't have a vaccine for it, unlike hepatitis A and hepatitis B, where you can be protected by vaccination. We have no vaccination for hep C. And of course, because we didn't have a test for so many years, we couldn't identify cases and we couldn't screen blood. So having had a blood transfusion is also a risk factor. And essentially, anybody born between about 1944 and 1974 is the upper age, is advised to get tested now for hepatitis C, and you'll see a really nice ad with some people wandering thoughtfully through the forest, looking at the redwoods, you know, contemplating their lives. They're all very attractive people in their late 50s or early 60s, in emphasizing the baby boomer aspect of this. And the reason you're seeing those ads is because we now have a drug. And the company that makes that drug and charges $80,000 for a course of it is very interested in finding as many people with hepatitis C as possible. Now, here's the problem with hepatitis C. There's plenty of people with hepatitis C antibodies who have no evidence of liver disease, no elevated liver enzymes, no liver fibrosis, clean biopsies. Should they be treated with this $80,000 drug because they might someday have it? Or are they people who were exposed and cleared the virus and have the antibodies simply because they were exposed? Just like if you've been exposed to tuberculosis, you might have antibodies forever, even after tuberculosis treatment. Well, you know, people might show positive for herpes antibodies and never have an attack of herpes. So are they contagious? No, they probably aren't. What about hep C? Should we treat them? No. But case finding, finding those cases, making people scared, that's part of basic marketing. Now, if people with hepatitis C have evidence of liver damage, a certain number of them are going to progress over the years to full-out liver failure, and those individuals are going to have a real problem. They're going to need a liver transplant, much more than $80,000, more than $1 million probably. So what are we going to do? I guess we've wrapped up on hepatitis C, but it jumps me to talking about these really, really expensive drugs. So thank you, Pure Heart, for bringing up the topic. Let's move to a major drug study just initiated that is FDA approval now, potentially in the works for this. And the drug is going to be for a very large audience for heart disease. Now, anyone who's been a regular listener to this program has heard from me before talking about heart disease being an inflammatory illness. In other words, it's not your high cholesterol. That's enabling, but what it really is inflammation. This is why people with diabetes, an inflammatory disease, or psoriasis, an inflammatory disease, have much higher and earlier heart attacks. So higher rates, earlier age, due to the inflammation. This drug blocks using antibodies. It's an artificial antibody. These are called monoclonals, and it attacks interleukin-1b. Interleukin-1b is an inflammatory marker. It's a molecule that causes inflammation. And if you block it, then you can successfully reduce inflammation. And in this study, there were 10,000 people in the trial. They had all survived a prior heart attack, carried high levels of blood markers of inflammation, and there was a substantial improvement in event rates in the treatment group. And this has allowed the people to go forward with making a appeal to the FDA to approve this. Now, I will point out that most of the statins, which are the drugs that were supposed to be the be-all and end-all for heart attacks, so much so that it's almost anathema if your cholesterol is over 100 and over 200, or your bad cholesterol LDL is above 130, people are thinking about putting you on statins, feeling scared if you're not, and God forbid you should be over 50 and see a cardiologist, because they will pressure you majorly to be on a statin. And those are generic and cheap. The companies aren't making any money, so along comes this fancy monoclonal antibody. Oh, by the way, there's also a federal trial on an old generic drug, very cheap, called methotrexate, that probably works just as well as this stuff, which will cost about $64,000 a year. And let's remember that if you're in the Medicare donut hole, which many people will be if they start on this drug, you'll be into your donut hole before you're further through the first month of therapy. This is just crazy, and we should really think twice about letting a drug like this through. You'd have to really convince me that there aren't better ways of dealing with inflammation, like fish oil, one of my personal favorites, or any of the other agents that we know reduce inflammation. And we're going to the phones. We have Gloria. And Gloria, you're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
I'm not sure if this is off topic or not. It's about turmeric.
We're free form, and actually it's quite on topic. Go ahead.
All right. Well, a friend has told me that she has heard that turmeric is not effective unless it's taken with black pepper. Do you know if that's true?
It's one of those things that's sort of semi-true. We've got a lot of that going on, don't we? Thank you, Internet. Okay, so here's the scoop. If you buy turmeric, it's a powdered orange powder. It comes from a root. The curcumin, which is the active ingredient that's the anti-inflammatory NF-kappa B blocker, the thing we want, very, very good agent, anti-cancer, anti-inflammatory, just good across the board. But it isn't very absorbable. So there are several ways that you can get around that. And one of them is black pepper. About 10% black pepper by a volume to the turmeric is the ratio that is used in the product. So if I have some back to the earth people in my practice who want to grow their own, so to speak. They'll either grind the root, or they'll buy the powder and then grind up some pepper and mix them and put them in capsules. And so you can do that. You need about 2 teaspoons of the mixture a day to get about 500 milligrams of curcumin, which is the amount you want. There are also, of course, many wonderful companies who are happy to serve you by providing you with a nutraceutical version of curcumin, which will be treated either with liposomes or with other magic chemistry things to make it more bioavailable. So you can essentially do it the cheap way, or you can buy a product that just has the powder and the black pepper and take a lot of it. Or you can take these concentrated ones, which will tell you how much curcumin, absorbable curcumin there is. And you're looking for the words highly absorbable if you go that route.
Okay.
Liposome is one. Sometimes there'll be any SOME on the end generally means that it's been put in a little bubble that will fuse to the wall of your intestine and transport the stuff where it needs to go. I love curcumin. I recommend it to all of my patients with arthritis. I take it myself every day. I think it's an extraordinarily effective agent. It takes a little longer than ibuprofen, maybe 12 to 24 hours to get rolling. But once it's rolling, it's a very effective anti-inflammatory.
So what kind do you make your own?
No, I'm lazy. I'm lazy and I get wholesale.
Oh, well, sure.
So I take advantage of that. I use a product from Euromedica that's called, I'm blanking on what the name of the CuraPro, that's it.
CuraPro?
It's CuraPro.
CuraPro, okay.
Right, and so that's the product I've used. I always check out companies. I check to see that they're doing good manufacturing. I check to make sure that somebody independent, like Underwriters Laboratory, is looking at them every year and checking them for purity, lead, additives, not having the amount that they say they've got.
Oh.
Because it's a bit of a jungle out there in the natural product world. There's nothing to stop you from going out to your garden and getting a bunch of dried parsley leaves and chopping them up and putting them in capsules and calling this a help support healthy urinary tract agent and selling it. It does actually sort of help to support a urinary tract, and assuming you haven't been spraying and there's not lead in your soil, you're okay. But a lot of these herbs do get imported from other countries. And some herbs actually, this is one I bet you didn't know. kale actually concentrates cadmium. So if you happen to have cadmium in the soil, and that can happen naturally because that's an earth mineral, then it will concentrate in your kale, and you can actually get elevated and potentially toxic levels of cadmium if you're doing your health, your kale shake every day with the best of intentions of improving your health.
Oh, uh-huh.
Now, that's just to say that the devil's in the details. I mean, rice has arsenic, but the fact that kale concentrates cadmium made me look at, you know, is that unique to the other crucifers? And it actually is. So I'm more of a fan of broccoli sprouts. If you're trying to get those, if you're trying to be healthy, I usually tell people do broccoli or broccoli sprouts rather than kale, because they don't bioconcentrate metals particularly quickly.
Uh-huh. Well, that, wow, you've given me so much good information. I thank you so very much.
You're very welcome, and thank you for the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now to Janet. Hello, Janet.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to bend your ear a bit about migraine.
Go for it.
I'll give you just a little bit of history, but it's actually not for me. I had my first one when I was 16, and so I've suffered with me for a long time. It's gotten better, you know, as I've aged, for probably different reasons. I knew it. Figured out what my triggers were, and that helped a lot. As an adult, I discovered siblings suffered with them too,
mm-hmm.
and my children get them. Now, this is what I wanted to ask you about. I had a couple as a younger adult. Well, not young, but it, and I felt like I was. Not that I was having a stroke, but that it might have been stroke-related.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of my daughters has had a couple where she loses her sense of self, and that she doesn't, when it hits her, she loses where she is, mm-hmm. who she is, who she's with.
Right.
I've been on the net, and they just don't have much that I've found.
Right.
Well,
it's, yeah.
The
internet's, well, you know, let me just go with this, because it's very, very important. Statistically, and start with the big picture. Statistically, if you have a history of migraines, you have an increased risk of dry stroke. That is to say, not the ones where your brain bleed, but the ones where you have where your blood flow doesn't get to a part of the, of the brain, and some of those cells die back. So that's more common, particularly little tiny ones in the base of the brain in people with migraines. And that's just one of those things that, you know, you've got a lot of good stuff in the DNA, but you get some bad stuff. Managing the migraines with preventative agents probably lowers the risk, but nobody's really proved that. It just makes sense that it would, because here's what a migraine is. There's a wave of serotonin that erupts, kind of like a little volcano, and spreads across the brain. And this doesn't hurt, but it causes the blood vessels that feed the brain to constrict and contract. And people will sometimes get a prodrome. In my case, haven't had a migraine for years, knock wood, but the prodrome was little sparkly, zigzaggy rainbows at the corners of my peripheral vision. Sometimes they'd be right in the front of my vision and I wouldn't be able to read. You close your eyes and the zigzags are still there, so you know it's not coming from your eyeball, it's coming from your brain. So that's a migraine prodrome. And then 15 to 30 minutes after that stopped, I would get a pounding headache. And what's going on is that I've gotten that spasm of the blood vessels. Part of my brain's not getting enough juice. It sends out an SOS. It says, hey, open up the feed. And so the brain's blood vessels open up, but they overshoot. And now you have this pounding, surging blood that's stretching literally the surface of the brain, these very sensitive tissues that are full of nerve endings. We call them meninges. And so as the meninges pulse, you have a pulsatile pain. It can be very, very severe. People who have the lack of blood flow, not to the eye, but to some other part of their brain, can get facial paralysis. They can have a loss of dexterity in a hand. They could conceivably have a cognitive prodrome, which it sounds like your daughter's having, where she's just having a brownout, brain fog, because she's not getting enough blood to the part of the brain that does the thing that tells her who and where she is. People who have familial migraines are likely to carry a mutation in something called superoxide dismutase. It's one of our free radical scavengers that protect the mitochondria. And so people with familial migraine, I will just empirically suggest they get a 23andMe and look for an SOD mutation. If they can't spend the money on a genetic test, which many of us cannot, then just empirically start taking a couple milligrams of manganese, not particularly for the migraines so much as to plug a hole that the migraines are a symptom of. Loss of superoxide dismutase does more than just predispose you to migraines. It predisposes you to cancer. And we can plug that hole, if you will, by goosing the enzyme with extra manganese. And we know that from experiments. So just a little tidbit for you and your family. And I would also look very carefully at preventative therapies. One really good preventative therapy that's healthy is Feverfew, which is a flower. It has to come, this is back to that thing I was saying to the other lady about you got to know your products. The plant has to be at least 3 years old, and the active part is the roots. So if you take the roots of the Feverfew that's at least a three-year-old plant, you get this active component called parthenolide. So, that's spelled like the Greek Parthenon, except olide on the end, O-L-I-D-E. Parthenolide is the active ingredient that prevents the migraines. So Feverfew is a very safe agent. The only thing you have to do is if you're going to have like major surgery, you stop taking it for a couple of weeks before the major surgery. But aside from that, it's very safe. It doesn't interact with drugs or other herbs, and you can take it long-term as a migraine preventative. Magnesium is another thing. So we got manganese, now we got magnesium. A lot of people find that if they take extra magnesium, they get fewer migraines. And so these would be natural solutions. And we also have drugs, topiramate, which is an anti-seizure agent. That's got an extraordinarily good record at low doses, not at the seizure level, not at the sedative level, for preventing migraine attacks. So if someone's having them more than once a month, I consider that an indication for preventative therapy. And some doctors will use beta blockers or calcium channel blockers. Topiramate is one that I use probably as my first line agent, because weight loss is one of its side effects. It's got a mild appetite suppressant effect. And most of the people in my practice, and there is exceptions, but the majority could stand to lose a few pounds. So you get a little help with that, and you also get a little help with your migraines. So you can go the natural route. Nice thing about this topiramate, it's now generic, and last time I checked GoodRx, it was still affordable. So unless Nathan Skrellage buys it up, I think it's a possibility that that might work for you and your family.
Good. So that's a lot of information.
I'm talky. That's why I'm on the radio.
No, it's great. I'm going to go back and listen to this at least once, if not twice. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call. I hope I've helped.
Oh, yes.
All right.
Very much.
Bye-bye for now. So back to expensive drugs, and this one made the news this week. FDA approved a very expensive cancer therapy. It's a fascinating type of therapy. It's approved for beta cell acute leukemia, lymphoblastic leukemia. This is one of the more difficult leukemias to treat, and it's only approved for people who have resisted standard treatment or relapsed, although those sorts of recommendations get thrown out the window immediately as soon as a drug is approved. It can be used outside of that if you can, well, in this case, find someone to pay for it, because it is $475,000. That's at least what Novartis is planning on charging for it. The approval was based on a trial of only 63 severely ill people, but the remission rates, and these were people with untreatable, intractable disease who'd already failed various chemotherapies and were really looking at dying from this, 83% got a remission within 3 months. Very high rate. And this drug starts in development all the way back in 1989. The concept of taking your own T cells, this is why I find it so fascinating, taking your own cells out of your blood, just draw some blood, spin it, pull off the white blood cells, separate out the T cells based on their antigens, and then feed those grow those T cells up in a lab, get a whole bunch of them, and then infect them with a virus. And the virus contains the DNA for a, well, in the case of this drug, CD20, which is a marker that's uniquely found on the leukemia cells, the beta cells. So you can attack the CD20 cells, which are reproducing at a very, very high rate, and you can kill the cancer cells rapidly using these antibodies, because these are killer T cells. They go after what their target is. I'm always imagining it like a hound dog. You got the hound dog and you let him smell a sock or a glove and then you let him loose and he runs throughout the bloodstream chasing down that particular smell and biting it whenever he sees it. And that's basically what these beta cells do. Fabulous results. But a little bit of an overreaction can happen because suddenly you've killed off lots and lots of cells. You can get a cytotoxic reaction, what's called a cytokine storm. So we have to be very careful with the dosing on these agents. And some of these people who, let's admit it, are going to die anyway from this disease if they don't flip the coin and roll the dice, so to speak, on this therapy, will die anyway because of complications of the therapy. And so we want to understand that these are dire circumstances, and with respect to actually growing someone's own T cells in the lab and then training them to attack their cancer, this is going to be colossally expensive and difficult. It's going to require a lot of science, and it's going to be hard to scale this up as a cancer cure for less dangerous cancers. That being said, it's pretty interesting stuff. What can you do instead of spending the $475 for these kids and young people? Well, you could spend $1 million or $800,000 if you get a deal on buying them a bone marrow transplant. But the fatality rate on bone marrow transplants is still close to 10% because the person is completely vulnerable to all infectious disease for weeks after you've killed off their bone marrow and before the new bone marrow that doesn't have the cancer is able to grow up and be able to protect them. So quite a substantial change. Now, a couple of short stories. I liked this one. This was a couple of weeks ago. But American Sign Language could soon have a way to easily communicate those who don't understand sign. Basically, there's an electronic glove that can translate American Sign Language into text and send that text to your cell phone. So people who are deaf might be able to wear a glove and literally type in on a keypad on the back of the glove the phone number of the person they wish to text to, and then use symbols to send a text. And this would be much, much quicker. And you could also use it for communicating in a classroom. I could see lots of applications. The two gloves worn on a person, it should be able to translate any ASL sign. And the cool thing about this was that this cost, the prototype, cost $100 to build. And that's from components that people went off and bought, online, electronic components. And they were able to build something that would track the motions and translate the sign language, and it doesn't look very heavy. It doesn't look any heavier or more difficult than a ski glove. So, thought that was a little interesting, weird science thing. And we're going to go right to our next caller, and that is Barbara. Hello, Barbara, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. Thank you for being there and doing so much for all of us.
Well, you're very welcome. I enjoy it. It really is my way of giving back to this community, which has given me so much.
We can tell. We could tell in your voice how you feel about us all. We're blessed, and bless you. I'm calling about a high-definition ultrasound test, and I was advised maybe to get a colonoscopy, and someone told me that they can find out the same results through the high-definition ultrasound.
What are we trying to find out?
They want to find out if they're looking to see if there's any cancer inside of me.
Okay. So high-definition ultrasound is very good for looking at things that are inside fluid. So, for example, looking at babies who are floating in amniotic fluid.
Mm-hmm.
And ultrasound really works much better in a fluid medium. So you need something that has a different fluid density, could be full of air, for example, like a cyst, or much firmer, much denser than fluid, like, say, a muscle. And then you have really good ability to differentiate. If we're looking for colon cancer, particularly in its earlier stages, you're going to have a little difficulty. And I have not seen anything that about a high sensitivity ultrasound that shows any head-to-head studies comparing it with, say, colonoscopy, virtual colonoscopy, which is a CT scan with contrast, so you still have to take the stuff that gives you the runs,
right,
is the alternative to colonoscopy if you're actually hunting for something.
Right.
And so I would say that somebody's trying to say sell you a bill of goods here. And I don't think it's equivalent. I'm sorry to say.
Right, that's what I thought, too.
Yeah.
Bless you, and thank you again so much for all you do.
You're very welcome, and just keep it coming.
Well,
all right.
Bye-bye.
Bye. We're going to answer an email from Dan in Monterey. And Dan writes, peripheral neuropathy. My primary symptom is pins and needles, most intense in the bottoms of my feet, where it all began. I spoke to you on the phone 6 to 7 years ago, and you recommended a cream compounded at a pharmacy in Capitola, and that helped. Recently, I was treated at the Las Vegas Neuropathy and Pain Center. They used electrical stimulation and injections, which helped quite a bit. But when the treatments ended, the symptoms have gradually returned. Currently, our friend Dan is taking a high dose of a seizure medicine, gabapentine. It's a second drug called Lyrica, and a third drug called nortriptyline, all to try to handle his symptoms. And he'd like to reduce the meds, but his neurologist tells him that's not going to be possible. Dan then goes on to relate something that's interesting, and I think very significant, that when he's standing on soft surfaces, such as grass, dirt, sand, the pain increases dramatically. But he's better when he's on hard, flat, artificial surfaces. Also, using his quadricep muscles in the front of his legs dramatically increases the peripheral neuropathy, so it makes it hard for him to ride a bicycle. And that clue, Dan, about that made me tell you, I don't think your problem is entirely peripheral neuropathy. I think you have some structural issues. So the first recommendation I have for you is to go and get, probably cost you $30, just to get a standard one, but go and get a good solid foot arch support orthotic. Horst Schneider's in our local community of Santa Cruz has a good selection of those. I'm sure there's somewhere down in Monterey. I don't know which pharmacy to direct you to in that area. And I would take some shoes that you wear a lot in and go to a place that has these orthotics, rather than buying one online, because you really do want to work with somebody who can advise you and make sure that it doesn't hurt more. But I think you need to support your arches and prevent your foot from moving around. All of our feet have tendons. The tendons and ligaments wear out and get stretched out. And I don't see how soft surfaces like grass and sand would aggravate it unless there were a structural component. So I want you to give that a try. I also was struck by your comment about using your quadricep bothering the symptoms. And so I think what may have happened is that you have developed over the years a secondary structural issue in the spine. And I recommend that you think about getting a lumbar image, maybe a lumbosacral MRI or a CT scan, and have them look for spinal stenosis. You can also see a neurologist and ask for testing for that. But I think there might be something mechanical going on that could potentially be aggravating or flaring the symptoms. And the other thing I wanted to ask, I wish that I had you on the phone, was does it hurt more when you stretch your quadriceps or when you stretch the back of your leg? Because if that's bothering you more on the feet, then that's good evidence that we're on the right track here with this. Another quick email going out to Barry in Pacific Grove, an old friend and former patient. Barry writes, I hope all goes well with you. Our friend in San Diego got these medical results and was told to go on a fish and vegetable diet. He's already on a statin and already on meds for high blood pressure. I'm wondering what else you would advise. So I'm going to go through these quickly. The gentleman in question has mild heart failure. He has a little bit of dilation of his aorta, not unusual in a 72-year-old. He has maybe 50% stenosis of the anterior artery on his heart. That's not a good thing for him to have. And he has a lot of calcium in his arteries, which he has a calcium score in the 68th percentile for age. So one of the things I'm recommending for your friend, Barry, is a combination of high-dose fish oil, and by that I mean EPA and DHA, which are components of fish oil, at about 2,000 milligrams. Both of these bits of advice are assuming he's not on blood thinners, because you shouldn't do that if you're on a blood thinner. And the other thing I would recommend is a type of vitamin K called MK7, maybe 150 to 300 micrograms a day of this, and you can find that at a vitamin store. This should not be taken if he's on Coumadin, a type of blood thinner, but if he's not on that, then this will actually work to start taking some of that calcium out of his arteries. And the less calcium you have, the more flexible the arteries, the less likely you are to trigger a heart attack. So it's an extremely important thing for you to tell your friend. Obviously, he probably should be taking that high-dose fish oil and maybe a baby aspirin, depending on what his GI tract is like. I found that the 2,000 milligrams of EPA DHA seems to thin the blood very effectively and cause the same sort of bruising that aspirin does, so I feel we're on the right track here with the natural agents, but I am not able to show you a good placebo-controlled double-blind study that shows stroke prevention. I can show you one for heart disease reduction with the fish oil that actually beat Lipitor head-to-head, at least the lowest dose of Lipitor, in a blinded study. So pretty darn good data, if you ask me. We're running up on the end of the hour, but I have a couple of cool stories that I wanted to share with you. And this one is all about the dangers of your kitchen sponge. You will be surprised to learn that a new German study found that kitchen sponges harbor a stunning amount of bacteria, and microwaving or boiling your sponge doesn't help. In fact, it actually makes it worse. Because when, just like with the C. difficile we talked about earlier this hour, there's a bacteria called Moraxella that is very, very dangerous and quite rare, but it likes water and it grows in your sponge. When you microwave or boil and you kill off the other bacteria, that allows the clone of the Moraxella to expand into the environment. The sponge is just such a lovely inhabitant. A lovely environment for the bacteria. Now, here's what they found. They found when they looked at 14 used kitchen sponges, they found 362 different species of bacteria. Yikes! there were 82 billion microbes. Okay, folks, and this is going to gross you out. It's the same density as you find in a fresh human stool sample, in your old sponge. They recommend changing the sponge weekly, and I'm going with it. But it's particularly important if there's a baby or an older person or someone getting chemotherapy in your house. You want to really be switching out the kitchen sponge on a weekly basis. You're talking a buck, probably less if you buy them in bulk, to keep your family safe. And I'm particularly talking to people with young children because I think this is a serious potential risk, especially for newborns. Got another email here from Rebecca in Sunnyvale, and this is a quick one. Rebecca writes, on your last show, you advised listeners to consider drinking filtered or purified water. Yes, I did, and we've been talking about problems with water supply, hexavalent chromium, arsenic, all these sorts of things that can sneak into your water supply and don't necessarily sneak out. What Rebecca wants to know is, do I have any recommendations on a system? What are the most important features to look for? Do you have to use reverse osmosis? Do you have to alkalinize the water? And so, Rebecca, if you want to get rid of the chlorine taste, you can just run your water through a charcoal filter like a Brita or one of the other companies. That won't take out heavy metals, and that's one of the major issues. It won't take out nitrates either. So you really need to spring for a reverse osmosis system, or buy your water from one of those reverse osmosis stands that are in front of most supermarkets. Bit of a pain, but this is what I recommend, particularly if you have health issues. I think it's very important to drink a lot of water, and it's very important that that water be pure. As far as alkalinizing the water is concerned, I personally do not believe that alkalinizing water is necessary, but if you want to do that, you can either add a pinch of bicarbonate of soda or a little bit of lemon juice, about half a lemon in 8 to 12 ounces of water is a very strong alkalinizing agent for your body. And it seems kind of paradoxical because it's acidic, but your body, in processing the lemon juice, actually generates alkalinizing agents, and it's a healthy way to do it. So you don't need an expensive alkalinizing system to get the results.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.